Nastasis. Please go ahead.
Much appreciated. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone on today's locking of a domain name subject to UDRP proceedings drafting team call on Thursday, the 2nd of August. We have Michele Nalon, Alan Greenberg, Laurie Anderson, Matt Schneller, Celia Lerman-Friedman, Hago Dafala, Christine Dorain, Boudouin Chambé will be joining us in 30 minutes, Faisal Shah, apologies noted today from Gabriel Eslak and Juan Manuel Rojas. Akiko has also just joined the audio bridge. We have Luke Seifer, who is on the Adobe Connect, who has not yet joined the audio bridge. And if I could, from sub-staff, we have Margie Milam, Barry Cobb, and myself, Gisela Gruber. Lisa Garano has also just joined us on the audio bridge. And if I could also please remind everyone to state their names when speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you. Over to you, Michele.
Thanks. And we also have apologies from Volker Greiman. Or Greiman, I don't know how you pronounce that.
Thank you, will be noted, thank you.
He's on holidays in Japan, I believe, for a couple of weeks. Good afternoon, good morning, good whatever time zone you're in. As per usual, I have to ask, does anybody have any updates to the statement of interest or their other thing, conflict of interest? Going once, going twice. No? Okay, no takers. Fine. Moving on. So we're continuing to look at the survey responses, and we've got a few there. We also have one comment on the public forum, as in the public comment thing. I will paste a link to that into the Adobe chat. And in the interests of transparency, I should let you know that the comment is from our, as in Black Knight's, external legal counsel. It is not a comment endorsed by us or anything like that, but I did encourage him to actually submit a comment. So I managed to get one more member of the public to submit a comment. I'm very proud of myself.
It's Alan. Will you help us translate the comment?
Of course. Of course.
There's an expression in it, on foot, which I've never heard before. And he uses it several times. I just put something in the chat about it.
Okay, is that an Irishism?
Oh, well, what is it then?
Oh, okay. I don't know. I thought it was English. I mean, I could be wrong, but a bit like Oscar Wilde, I am Irish. People have to tell me when I'm...
Just tell us what it means.
On the basis of.
Okay, thank you.
As a result of, on the basis of. So one of the things is it is our experience that many issues arise in relation to the ongoing use of a domain name in relation to a UDRP.
Ah. Okay.
Well, that would be one translation. Unless I'm misunderstanding what on foot of. Yeah, it's usually the basis of something.
Okay, that fits in the other uses. Thank you.
Okay. I thought we spoke English, and now I've just been proven wrong. Okay.
They are dialects.
No, I know.
For the transcript, that was Alan speaking when it wasn't Michele.
Okay, and for the transcript, Alan is the one with the interesting vowels. Michele is the one with the thick Irish accent. Okay, then. So anyway, we've had one comment. I know a couple of members of the group have been doing their best to promote the comment period via various means. One member of the group, who I won't name, but who is connected to the call somehow, has been trying to attract attention on Twitter with some very funny tweets to promote it. I'm not sure if we're going to get much back, but hey, at least we've tried. Okay, so going back to the survey results and everything else, Barry sent out a couple of spreadsheets where he tried to do some work on the analysis, and he also forwarded an email to the list from, I think it was the Czech court. Is that correct, Barry?
Barry, yes, it is.
Okay. Okay, with regard to the what's up on screen here, because that's the updated results, fine. I can't move that, though. Damn it. Oh, you can move it. Woohoo. Right. With regards to the Czech court, could you actually put that response up on screen, because it's not a very long email.
Give me just a second. Actually, I'm having a slight technical difficulty. I didn't PDF the email, and I can't share my screen at the moment.
Okay, well, look, let's just... actually, we've had replies from WIPO as well, and...
This is Christine. I had emailed Marika, but I realize she's out of the office. We'll send our reply next week. We're still gathering the data.
Okay, thank you. Okay, well, Barry has sent two responses to the list. One is from WIPO, and the other one is from the Czech court. The most recent one would only have landed in your inboxes probably within the last couple of minutes, in other words, since the beginning of this call. Since Barry can't share his screen, I will dig up the one from the Czech court. So a couple of clarifications. So the question, in approximately what percentage of UDRP proceedings that you handle do registrars lock the domain names at issue taken... At issue taken on a representative sample UDRP disputes that you have had experience with. They've clarified to say about 90%. Question 5, in approximately what percentage of UDR proceedings that you handle do registrars fail to confirm lock of the domains, etc., etc., etc.? And they said between 25 and 30%. The question 8, in approximately what percentage of UDRP proceedings that you administered are you aware of the registrar having confirmed lock of a domain name and replied to requests for registrar verification from you, but on which there were nonetheless subsequent material changes to the registrant data, and they said they've only ever had one case, which in percentages was about 1%. The next question, in approximately what percentage of... we've got stuff. Oh, we have got stuff on screen now. Okay. The next one, approximately what percentage of UDRP proceedings that you have administered are you aware of the registrar's confirmed domain name lock failing to prevent an apparently prohibited transfer to another registrar? And again, it's 1%, so I presume this is all the same case. And basically all the issues they seem to have are actually with one particular incident that they've had, so it's kind of rare, I think, is the upshot of that one. Any comments or other thoughts on this from anybody in relation to the Czech arbitration court? No? Okay. And we have one from WIPO. So the first question with regard to locking, they said it was about 99%. Okay, WIPO's obviously dealt with a larger number of disputes. So they're saying that in question number 5, what percentage do registrars fail to confirm lock? They came back with approximately 6%. Question 8, the modification to the registrant data, again, a low figure. 2%. Percentage of UDRP proceedings that confirm lock failure to prevent an apparent transfer, 0. Next one was down 1%. Relevant the who is registrant content again, it was a 2%. And the last one, this penultimate ones, in approximately what percent of UDRP proceedings where registrars confirmed domain name lock pursuant to UDRP, yada, yada, yada. This around renewals, 16% involved an expiration issue, and of the 16% of administered cases, in approximately 75% of these, the registrar indicated the lock itself would be sufficient to keep the dispute name active without payment pending resolution of the proceedings. Many also indicate that the domain name would also expire immediately on conclusion of the UDR proceeding without appropriate payment of the applicable fee by the successful party. Is somebody trying to speak there? No. Okay. Last one. If a UDRP proceeding is decided in favour of the registrant, in what percentage of cases are you aware of where the registrar would not have unlocked the domain name once the 15-day wait period has expired? And basically, the answer there is none. So, any comments or feedback or thoughts or observations? From anybody? Nothing? Luke, any observations as a registrar?
No, not really on that.
Okay. Anybody else have any observations? Mash? Thoughts? Laurie? Christine? Anybody? Alan?
McKaylee, hi. It's David from WIPO.
Hi, David.
Hello. Hey, listen, just an additional point to make in respect of the data that we have put in concerning instances of, apparent registrant breach of paragraph 8A, so transfers of registration during a pending UDRP proceeding.
Sorry, was that registrar breach or registrant breach?
Registrant breach. Yeah, so these are instances in which a registrant is transferring the domain name during the pendency of a UDRP proceeding in apparent breach of paragraph 8A. Although the instances in which the sampled instances in which we saw this occurring are statistically pretty insignificant at somewhat less than 1%, there are still cases in which it is occurring. In the dozens rather than the tens of thousands. And in those cases where we have observed it, there have been pretty significant procedural complexities that have tended to result from that. So although there's not a large number of these cases by overall volume, where they do occur, it can be quite difficult and time-consuming then for the provider and for the parties to take the necessary steps to sort it out or to amend the pleadings, and then for the panel in due course to render a decision on what has actually happened. I'll send an email. I'll just put an email into the GNSO list in which I'll include a couple of examples of cases in which there have been some instances of these breaches occurring, in which there have been some procedural complexities that resulted from that, just to fill out that response in a little bit more detail.
Okay, just for by way of clarification, because, sorry, I'm not as au fait with the finer points of the UDRP as a lot of other people on this call. You consider these breaches to have been committed by the registrant or the registrar?
By the registrant, because the prohibition under paragraph 8A of the rules precludes the registrant from transferring the domain name during the pendency of a UDRP proceeding. Typically, there is, I suppose you'd call it a practice under the UDRP, of course, under which registrars, of which we have observed many engaging in this practice, lock the domain name during the pendency of a UDRP proceeding to prevent such breaches from occurring. But where they do occur, of course, it's a breach that, in our view, occurs on the basis of actions that the registrant has taken.
Okay, and just again another follow-up question, because I'm a bit thick. Is now, when you say the pendency of a UDR I'm really having difficulties with sentences with more than about two words today. When you refer to the pendency of a UDRP proceeding, do you mean that the registrar has already formally been informed by WIPO of the UDRP, or is this prior to that, or exactly what point in the timeline are we talking about?
In our view, it would certainly be the point at which the registrar receives notice from the provider, advising them that a complaint has been filed and asking the registrar to provide certain information about the domain name, and also asking the registrar to confirm that the domain name had been locked. That would certainly be a point, in our view, at which the proceeding becomes pending. But there can also be earlier points in time as well. So, for example, when the complainant files the complaint with the provider and the complainant copies the registrar and the registrant on that filed complaint, I mean, the proceedings are also pending as of that point.
Okay. And again, yes, another follow-up question. Some of this stuff at the... David, I'm sorry for kind of monopolizing you with questions, but just some of this stuff, it's really... It's not 100% clear to me personally, which is why I'm asking you so many questions, and I thank you for your patience. And other people in this group, please, if you have a question for, or think that I'm monopolizing David or anybody else, please do say so. Typically, how long does it take between when you in WIPO receive a complaint before you actually send out the notification to the registrar? I mean, are we talking about an hour, a day, 2 days, 3 days? I mean, what kind of timeline are we talking about?
It would typically be in under 12 hours.
Okay. That's fine. That's all I want to know. Laurie, go ahead.
Hi, this is Laurie. This is precisely the reason why we'll lock the name on notice from the complainant, especially if the provider is copied on the email, because if the domain name, if for some reason the respondent finds out about it prior and, decides to try and flee, it's just a nightmare trying to get the domain name back.
Okay.
Yeah, Michele, this is Christine. One of the hang-ups of the UDRP is that the complainant, when they serve the complaint on the provider, they have to also copy the respondent at that time, which gives the respondent, I think WIPO does this too, but most of the providers, I think, then say also serve the registrar. And we've done that because we are hoping that maybe it could prevent some cyber flight, because what's happening is that as soon as the respondents become aware of the complaint, they try to ditch the domain name. Not everyone, but some do, which causes a problem, and the registrars are sort of hunting to try to get it back or do whatever they need to do. And so that's one of the situations, and I think that's sort of what Laurie was addressing, is that the respondent, if they find out about it right away, they are going to kind of cause a problem, and that's why the registrars, some of them like to lock right away.
Okay, thank you for the clarification. Anybody else have any comments or thoughts?
Michele, it's Alan. I'm not at my computer right now.
That's okay.
Yeah. With regard to the last comment, we've heard other things, that some registrars do not want to lock it because an email from a complainant, can be fake, can be spoofed, and that could be a way of getting someone's domain locked improperly. And some registrars are leery of doing a lock until they hear from the dispute provider. The two seem to be at odds. Can anyone address that?
Christine or David or Laurie?
Or maybe some people are just more afraid, that more cautious than others.
I think you're right. They are at odds. I mean, I think it's different registrars have taken different tacks, and perhaps, you know, some registrars respond so fast. So, for instance, if we get a complaint filed at 9 a.m., we oftentimes can request a lock as early as 10 a.m., and some registrars, you know, like GoDaddy, you know, we'll hear back from them within the hour. And so things move relatively quickly. But if a complainant files their complaint at, you know, 8 p.m., you know, Central Time, we're not in the office. We're not going to see it till we get in the next day. There are some registrars, I think, who see that email. They see that we were copied. And we talked a little bit about this. And, yeah, it might be a little bit of a risk, but I'm assuming the registrar's legal counsel has sort of figured out, like, what's that level of risk that they want to take. Do they want to have, you know, do they want to sort of have these domain names, you know, constantly be deleted out? And, you know, what's the chance? I mean, I suppose until something bad happens, they decide, well, that's the easier course to take. If the provider's obviously been copied, this looks like a legitimate complaint, we'll lock it down. But as you, as the data pointed out and as sort of the conversation went a week or so ago, I mean, it's kind of the, I think it's still the minority of registrars that are going to lock without hearing from us as providers. You know, most of them are going to wait. And like I think I said in an email a couple weeks ago, what happens is that I've even had where people have locked, and then in the very rare instances in which there really wasn't a complaint filed, they've gotten an email back from the registrar saying, hey, you know, we got this yesterday. We haven't heard from you. We know you're pretty quick about this. What's going on? So, you know, in that case, you know, the domain name's unlocked, you know, 24 hours later. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I think you're right. I think there's no real you know, consensus, which I think is kind of why we're all here, right?
Yeah, I was trying to understand is you know, if we made a rule saying registrars must lock as soon as they get an email from the complainant, you know, within some number of hours, is that going to cause legal issues with some registrars and things like that? And that, and well, clearly, if we made the rule, it wouldn't cause legal issues. But the question is that something we should be doing? So I was trying to understand the implications of it, and I think I do now. Thank you.
It's probably, sorry, this is David again from WIPO. It's maybe also worth adding to that, that in these sorts of situations, of course, it's not just an email that the registrar and that the provider and that the respondent would receive. It would be an email that would also include a copy of the complaint and any necessary supporting annexes and an indication of payment, and all of the sort of information that, as a registrar, you could take some confidence from in ascertaining that it was likely to be a bona fide filing and not just some sort of, you know, spurious request. And obviously, if it would be a spurious request, then, you know, the registrar could also check that with the provider, as sometimes happens.
Yeah, I guess a follow-up. Given that the providers turn around quickly and tell the registrar to lock, they can't do much checking to make sure it's not a spurious request at that point.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry, this is David again. Well, at WIPO, there are two checks that we do. We do a check on the initial filing of the complaint where we're doing a quick scan basically to ascertain that the complaint has not been the subject of an earlier refiled complaint decision at another provider. You know, we check to make sure that the contact information is in place and that the supporting evidence is there, and that the complainant has, you know, trademark rights. And then if that is all in order, then we would proceed to issue the lock request to the registrar on that basis.
So you do check whether the trademark rights seem to be valid.
Well, we don't do a validity check because the assessment of trademark rights in due course is of course for the panel to consider under the first element. But if there would be no trademark rights at all asserted, and no discussion in the complaint about the trademark rights that the complainant would claim, then we would query that, and we would probably not accept the complaint at first instance because the rules do require some minimal discussion by the filing complainant.
Okay, but if I filed a complaint claiming I had the rights to the name ICANN, as a random example, you wouldn't actually check the documents as long as I asserted rights to it. Okay.
As long as a statement was made asserting...
Yeah.
Okay. Trademark rights, then we would not hold the complaint up at that early point.
Thank you. I think I understand completely now.
Yeah, this is Christine. I was just going to say we do the same thing. Basically, we make sure that it's not fake, fraudulent, made up. You know, if someone sends us an email with six kinds of, et cetera. So same thing, you know, we're not going to request a lock unless it's a legitimate complaint.
The other point to note, sorry, David here again as well, is that the UDRP rules do require a filing complainant to swear and to attest as to the truthfulness of all of the claims made in the complaint and to include an electronic signature. So, of course, a registrar can also satisfy themselves from the provided complaint that that required attestation is included in the complaint on which they would be copied and filed with the provider. So that might be something that a registrar could also look at if it wanted to initiate a slightly earlier lock.
Okay, just one second. I've got Matt and Laurie in the queue. So Matt and then Laurie, please.
I was going to ask if anyone, either on the registrar or provider side, had seen an instance of a complaint that was apparently filed but ended up was just sort of a spoof where both the service provider and the registrar and registrant were all copied on the same email string or on the same email attaching all the information that David mentioned earlier.
Who was that speaking?
That was Matt.
Okay. Sorry, just for the record, please try to put your name, try to say who you are when you're speaking. So for the transcript, otherwise the transcript is going to look with lots of man speaking, woman speaking, which will add to the confusion. Does anybody have any reply to Matt? No? Okay. Laurie?
Yeah. Michele? Yes, Luke speaking. I don't know if Matt, that's what you're asking, which we had a few cases where the complainant did not pay the fee to the UDRP provider, and the whole proceeding just stopped.
Hey, this is Matt again. I guess one of the things that, at least when we're doing UDRPs, we tend to send out is for the systems that have electronic filing, you'll get a filing receipt back that indicates the payment has been made, which at that point can be attached to the email that's sent out as part of the payment verification documentation.
Anybody else? Anything else? Laurie?
Hi, it's Laurie. If we lock prior to verification request, we will follow up in a couple of days to make sure it's a valid complaint. But that said, we've only had one case in the last 6 years since I've been doing this that where the complaint was not actually filed. If that tells you sort of the volume of, I mean, we have a pretty high volume of cases, but, the danger of locking a domain name unnecessarily seems to be pretty minimal compared to the danger of it getting away if you don't lock it.
Laura, this is Michele. Just roughly how many cases would you guys be dealing with per year? I mean, approximately.
Are we talking about just arbitration, or are we talking about court and arbitration?
If we could stick to UDRP as opposed to frivolous lawsuits and every other legal issue that lands on your desk, because I'm sure that number is pretty high.
Roughly. I would say over 1,000.
Okay, thanks. Luke, roughly how many are you guys dealing with a year? He's deserted me. Okay, he might come back. Are any other registrars on this call? Master, you're a registrar, aren't you?
No, not a registrar.
Okay, sorry. Well, actually, I'm not going to apologize. If they call me registrar, it should be a compliment. Okay, I'll shut up. I'm going to get murdered the next time I turn up at an ICANN meeting. Okay, thanks, Laurie. I mean, just in terms of the volumes. Okay, speaking for us, the number of UDRP complaints we deal with is tiny by comparison. I think we've had six UDRPs, I think, for GTLDs in the past 2 years. So we're averaging three a year, roughly. But we're just not attractive for a lot of reasons. Which is why I'm still not happy. Sorry?
I said you're just lucky, Michaela.
I don't know about whether it's luck or not. But we're also significantly smaller than most of the other registrars. I mean, we're obviously way smaller than GoDaddy. We're also smaller than EuroDNS and Key Systems and a lot of the other ones who are involved in this working group. We started late. Okay. Any other comments or thoughts on this? On the feedback, the extra feedback we've had from the providers.
Miguel, this is Christine from NAP. I just wanted to mention, and as I mentioned before, we'll submit our final numbers again next week. I was out of the office and was busy, but I wanted to sort of mention, in line with what David said, and I think when we submit our more detailed numbers, I think I'm going to include something similar to what David mentioned also, but that is sort of the impact, yeah, the number of actual cases where there's a problem is in the, you know, 1%, 2%, 10% range, depending on the question that you're asking. But it's the amount of time and effort that it risk requires on everybody's part, the complainants, the providers, when the registrars and registrar, well, I mean, because the registrars haven't locked or whatever, that's where the kind of the problem comes in, where some of these things are a problem, where it's just, you know, hours and hours are spent trying to track this stuff down and make sure that the lock is in place so we can proceed, et cetera. So that's sort of, I think what I mean, I don't know, maybe it's clear, but I just want to make sure that was really clear. It's like we're here, specifically NAF is here in this conference because the impact of this, you know, 2 to 10% of cases is really burdensome, and that's really, I just didn't want people to think, well, it's only a few percent, it's not a problem.
Okay, thank you. Luke is back. So, Luke, can you hear us?
Yes, I do.
Okay, because when you dropped off the call, the question we were answering was, how many UDRP cases do you deal with per year? So, GoDaddy said about 1,000. I said about 3. How about yourselves?
I would say 2 dozen, yeah.
Okay, see, they're much bigger than us. You see, we're a small little registrar. I'm looking for sympathy. Okay, Christine, point taken. So Christine's point is that even though the percentage might be low, the impact and the burden is high. Would it be fair to say it's disproportionately high, or should I just say high, Christine?
I think disproportionately high. I mean, the amount of time it takes to handle the complex cases where there isn't a lock or somebody's messing with it is far more than it takes to handle all the rest of the cases combined.
Sounds a bit, it's that 80-20 rule, isn't it? Okay, then. Any other comments on this, or should we move on?
This is David. I would agree that disproportionately high is a fair characterization. The amount of time invested in rectifying vastly outweighs the amount of time we would spend administering a case in which these sorts of problems don't occur.
Okay, thank you. Alan, go ahead.
Yeah, I wonder to what extent is it possible to really quantify that those statements of disproportionately high. When I listen to it, what I'm hearing is if 2% of the cases take 5 times as much time, that's 10% of your overall time, and it's not a problem. If they take 100% of your time, if we could fix that, it would reduce the cost of a UDRP by half. So I'm trying to understand, get an order of magnitude for these, the impact of these problems. I'm not sure if that was blathering or that was clear what I was asking.
Okay, thank you, Alan. David or Christine, that's aimed at you, so if one of you would like to react. And Sherry Falco has joined, I see, as well.
You know, I'll see what I can do, Alan, when I put my numbers together. What I'll try to do is dig up a couple of cases and figure out sort of how much time I've spent handling the problem and maybe just let you know. I mean, it would just be a representative couple, but I could sort of let you know how much time was spent on some of those things. I'll try to do that when I submit my numbers next week. Would that be helpful?
Yeah, certainly. My gut feeling is that the amount of time you spent is onerous in regard to a single case, but it is not a significant part of your overall workload addressing those cases.
This is Christine. It can vary.
But if the answer, if my gut feeling is wrong, it's really important.
Well, you're probably right. Again, this is Christine. You're probably right because when I consider, you know, the 40-hour week, you know, 52 weeks a year, yeah, it's probably not 100% or 50% of my time. But I know that there are weeks where 2 whole days is spent dealing, 3 whole days, which seems like this massive proportion because it's just chewed up most of my week. Although you're probably right, if you stretch it out over the whole year, it's not taking 50% of my year. You see what I'm saying?
Even if it's 20%, it would be a really important issue. Anyway, I've asked the question if you can come up with any quantification that might be useful for us. Thank you.
This is David from WIPO. I'd just add to that one of the things that we do at WIPO to help us deal with the volume of time that can be required to solve these problems is we've set up a unit that we have some lawyers working in which we basically do, registrar liaison in situations where these sorts of problems have occurred. And, you know, These are staff members who are kept very busy rectifying these sorts of situations or trying to ascertain what has happened. And it can be useful, I think, to think about the number of people outside of the provider and the parties and the panel who can also need to be involved in sorting these sorts of situations out. So you have a situation where, for example, there's a change in the registrant data that comes to the attention of the provider. The provider then has to try and figure out what has happened, involving an examination of the who is and, the records that came in with the complaint at the time that the complaint was filed and the who is as it existed at the time of the apparent change. The provider then has to go back to the registrar and explain what they think has happened. They need to then wait for the registrar to examine the situation and come to a view themselves. That information then needs to be collated and looked at again by the provider, who then typically needs to go back out to the registrar, either to ask them what they can do to rectify the problem, which might involve some consideration by the registrar of whether or not it's appropriate to invoke the inter-registrar transfer policy, which then triggers up the setting up of a separate and subsequent process to resolve that question, or that the registrar might be able to resolve it directly by reverting to the original contact data, or they might not, in which case the provider then needs to go back to the complainant and ask the complainant to amend its complaint accordingly. The complainant typically is pretty annoyed about this, and so usually they'll dispute the change that the registrar's reported, and so sometimes the provider then has to go back to the registrar again and to ask them to reconfirm in light of anything the complainant may have had to say about it, often at length. Maybe then the registrar has some views about some of the things that the complainant has had to say, and it goes on and on. And eventually you get to the point where the proceeding gets notified, you know, to both the new registrant and the previous registrant from which the domain name had been transferred. And eventually you have a panel that gets appointed, and all of this material and all of these communications and that whole history then sits before the panel, who has to figure out what's happened. And the panel might need to issue some more orders to the parties and the registrar to try and get a clearer angle on it all, and then in due course they have to, you know, author and render their decision. And, you know, when you weigh that all up and you tote up all of the hours of all of the people, you know, involved in even just dozens of cases, I mean, it's a very significant amount of time and money and effort, which, you know, when you think that all you're really talking about is putting a lock on a domain name for an extra 12 hours, at the front end to try and offset that sort of an issue, it seems like a pretty small price to pay. Okay. But we'll, I mean, we'll also have a look at the numbers.
David, let's just slow down for a second, please, because I'm trying to process what you've been saying, and you said a huge amount of things in a short period, and I'm still having difficulty processing everything. So just please slow down for a second. Okay, so see if I can actually try to summarize what you said. You're basically saying that the timing of the lockdown of the domain has very broad ramifications on the entire dispute process.
I'm just saying that when we talk about the disproportionate impact of a failure to timely lock, we need to be thinking both about the relative ease of getting a slightly earlier lock in place and the relative lack of prejudice to a registrant that's affected by a slightly earlier lock, and weighing that against the amount of time that needs to be invested in sorting out and solving those situations where, you know, a lock doesn't come in and a registrant is able to, to act in breach of paragraph 8 and the steps that then need to be undertaken by all involved parties to try and figure out and resolve.
Okay, just breaking this up a little bit more. So in your personal view, would it be preferable that the registrars lock the domains as early as possible, as GoDaddy say that they do?
From our perspective, I mean, not just mine personally, but from our perspective as a provider, I mean, it's enormously helpful where a registrar can lock the disputed domain name as early as possible after their receipt of a filed complaint.
Right, but okay, that's not okay, David. I'm just going to push you a little bit on this. One of the issues that we're trying to address with this PDP is what constitutes a filed complaint.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the question I'm asking you is whether, if the registrar receives the notice of the complaint from the provider, in other words, yourselves, NAF, or the Czech Arbitration Court, or whoever, I think that's pretty clear. In other words, you know, one of the providers is formally notifying the registrar of the complaint of the UDRP. I think that's perfectly clear. If anybody disagrees with me on that, please say so. But I think that's pretty clear. The issue, from my understanding, the area where there is a grey area is if the registrar is, or the registrant, as somebody else has pointed out, is aware of the complaint earlier, let's just say, in the entire process. So the question I had for you was, would you personally be happier if the registrar were to lock as early as possible based on some kind, on any notice they had from whatever source of a UDRP dispute?
Well, certainly it would work for us if a registrar would lock a domain name that was the subject of a dispute on receipt of notification from a filing complainant, which included a copy of the complaint had been appropriately copied to the respondent and
okay,
to
so before, the so in other words, on its way to yourselves.
Well, I mean, what usually happens when a complainant files a complaint is that they send an email, to us at WIPO, and they copy the respondent and they copy the registrar on that email. The email includes a copy of the complaint. Some registrars lock at that point, and that's a helpful thing to do from our perspective, because it also means that in that period of time, for whatever that period of time is, between the filing of the complaint and the issuing of the verification request to the registrar, there is no risk of the domain name being transferred in breach of paragraph 8 of the UDRP. That's helpful.
Okay.
Well,
Alan, you've had your hand up for a couple of minutes. Go ahead, Alan.
Indeed. I want to bring something up, and I don't think I really want to discuss it now, but I want to get it on the table, because as I've been listening to this discussion, it dawns on me that a possible solution to a lot of these problems is to completely take the registrar out of the loop. And that is, the number of providers, dispute providers we have, is a small number, and they're accredited. They can be trusted. If we can provide, if a mechanism can be provided that they can enact the lock, either an automated process through the registrar or preferably directly to the registry to turn on some perhaps new lock that the registrar will recognize if it's there, we're avoiding this complete problem. We're taking a whole bunch of work off of a registrar and taking a whole lot of discretion out of the registrar to have to read the dispute, the complaint, and see whether it looks valid or not. And that may address an awful lot of our problems. Anyway, I said I'm not sure I want to discuss how good an idea it is right now, but I wanted to put it on the table so I didn't forget it. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Alan. Christine and Matt are both typing furiously on the chat, and just because I will. Christine puts to me, Michaela, in other words, I would add that while it's clear that the domain names should be locked at least as early as the provider notifies the registrar, codifying in the recommendation would be helpful for new or reluctant registrars who aren't currently doing so. Okay? Noted. And then from Matt to the providers, I wonder if the new e-filing system would allow providers to somehow automatically send a confirmation email akin to the filing receipt that NAF's online filing system sends out immediately upon e-filing to the registrant and registrar email addresses submitted by the complainant to provide an independent verification basically immediately after filing. That would provide something from the provider in advance of the notice of commencement. And then from Christine, from our perspective, that would be easy, but would only work for e-filers, as you noted. And again, this is Michele asking a really, really dumb question, because I honestly do not know the answer. Christine, what percentage of complaints are e-filed, or e-filers, or whatever the correct term is?
Boy, I'd have to look it up, but it is rising every day. This is Christine, sorry. I would say over 50% of filers are now using our electronic submission system. And then, you know, of course, the remaining just are emailing in the complaints.
Okay, thank you.
But
and David and Brian,
if I may
have any filing equipment? Sorry, who's that?
It's Alan. I want to follow up.
Okay.
When you're finished the screen.
Okay, and just very, very quickly, David and Brian, do you have an e-filing system of some kind?
Yeah, we have an automated filing system which parties can use, and it's something that technically is feasible to do. It's a bit more difficult if you're talking about email filing, of course, and the majority of our complaints at the moment would come in by email.
Okay, so for you, the percentage of e-filing is low at this stage?
I'd have to look at the numbers again, but I think it's probably around 90% based on email for us at the moment.
Okay, so 10% of using other methods. Okay,
yeah,
we're running out of time here, so I'm going to go back to Alan.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify. I'm not sure. I haven't read the chat's messages carefully, but what I was saying was not to get a quicker confirmation to the registrar, but to take them out of the loop altogether and say that the dispute resolution provider can, through some mechanism to be defined, maybe, can enact the lock themselves. And therefore, as soon as, you know, the people who are professionally able to look at a complaint and say, does this seem like a legitimate complaint, they could put the lock in without waiting for another message to go to the registrar and then the registrar to pick it up and take some action on it. And so that doesn't really alter whether it's done electronically or via email. It's as soon as the dispute resolution provider sees some action, it may happen in microseconds in the form of e-filing, and email might take hours. But again, as soon as there is reasonable knowledge that a complaint is being filed, the domain would be locked. And that's the concept that I think I'd like to explore later on.
Okay, thank you, Alan. The clock is ticking fast here, so I think we're going to really pretty much run out of time here. Just one thing. So, Alan, you're talking about something where the dispute resolution providers would notify the registry instead of the registrar. Is that correct?
Well, I don't know what the mechanism would be. It could be that since there are fewer registries than registrars today, that may not be the case next week or next year.
Try 2 years, but anyway.
2 years, yeah, well, where we may well have more registries than registrars. But ignoring the fact, it could be with either. We would have to invent the mechanism. If it was the registry would have to set some lock, which registrars would then have to check to make sure whether they're allowed to make certain changes or not. If it was done through the registrar, that may be more onerous because all the registrars would have to build the interface to talk to the dispute resolution providers. So, but it could be either one. The bottom line is, as soon as the dispute resolution provider gets a complaint and takes whatever, pushes the red button on their computer, the domain is locked.
Worth noting, David, from Wi-Fi.
That's the concept I was talking about, and I'm not sure. There are probably many ways to implement it, and perhaps it's not doable, but thank you.
Okay, go ahead, David, or Brian, or whoever it was.
Yeah, this is David. Just to note that one of the contemplated rights protection mechanisms that's intended to operate in the new GTLD space, the so-called Uniform Rapid Suspension System, does contemplate a lock mechanism that would be administered by the registry.
Okay. So that may be in line with what I'm suggesting. I forgot if that was in the original spec, I forgot that. So thank you.
And this is Christine. Additionally, with the URS, the respondent isn't notified until the lock is maintained, I believe, which will also help prevent cyber flight.
Actually, hold on a second. I'm a bit confused, but I thought the URS was only for Sunrise.
No.
Okay. Sorry. Now, there's a lot of this.
The trademark clearinghouse originally was only going to be for Sunrise, although it's now extended for 60 days into the registration, into the live period. The URS was always live.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I've been getting a lot of emails backwards and forwards to do with trademark clearinghouses and other things, which has confused me. Okay, we've got about 2 minutes left until the top of the hour, so rather than trying to proceed further with this and get completely bogged down, I'm going to thank you all for the very energetic discourse. ICANN staff people, Margie, who's been terribly quiet, or maybe was just logged in and said hello and hasn't been back since. We don't know. She's been very quiet. I know Gisela was there. Barry is definitely there. If you could possibly send the chat transcript to the list, because there's some interesting points backwards and forwards between various people on the subjects we were discussing. And if anybody has any issues, please raise them with the list, and we'll speak again. In 2 weeks' time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.